At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Gray Malkin Lane Patreon channel, where I get to talk about overlooked, supporting, and obscure characters. Today, we are going to be talking about a fan favorite supporting character, Stevie Hunter, former professional ballet dancer slash ballet teacher turned congresswoman in the more recent years in the Marvel Universe. I have a question. I'm fond of this character, but I've been positing as I prepared for this episode why it is that people like her. And I want to ask you both of my guests that as we're beginning, why do you like Stevie Hunter is my initial question. I think I'm on to it, but I want to make sure I get the right pulse on this. I'm going to welcome two wonderful guests that I love hanging out with on the show who are meeting for the first time, and you're both lovely, so I can't wait for you to be friends. Let's begin with the incredible Num One Cosplay. Num, welcome back to Gray Malkin Lane. Tell everybody your name and pronouns, and why do you love Stevie Hunter?
Hi, everyone. My name is Num One. I go by they, them. I think that I love Stevie because she is unafraid of entering this space where she's dealing with these very powerful and very, you know, interesting characters, and she holds her ground very well in the midst of, you know, a lot of chaos and a lot of things that she's very out of her depth on for the most part, especially when she gets to know the X-Men for the first part, I guess. And so I think it's very intelligent of her to handle things the way she does, but also, like, I think it's really important to have a person who can empathize with them as a person of color and facing discrimination and things like that. I think that is such a really important character. I think it humanizes the X-Men a lot and really, you know, shifts them into a very normal kind of view. I put that in parentheses because, you know, what is normal? But I think it's really important to have someone who isn't like a super person that can relate to them.
Yeah, so I think that's the first thing I latch onto with Stevie is she gives no fucks. Stevie cares about if you're a good person or not. Yeah. She doesn't care if you're a mutant or not. She's not afraid of you. But also don't fucking attack her place. Like, don't come after her, because that's why would people do that in this world? Let me also jump to my dear friend Carrie Harris returning to the show. Carrie, it's been too long.
Way too long. Let's not do this again. I'm coming back tomorrow. Carrie Harris, she, her. You know, I was going to say kind of the same thing about Num, and I don't want to jump the gun in talking about there's the Magneto moment, which is one of the best moments in comics ever. I dare you to say that it's not. You know, I think the other thing for me, in addition to what Num said, is that Stevie is a reminder of the normal world. Kitty Pryde is my character. She's the person who got me an X-Men because she was like me. She was just a normal, unremarkable girl, and she could be a superhero, so I could too. Stevie being a part of Kitty's world helped her feel like a normal girl, and Stevie being unremarkable herself but still being able to hang and bring something valuable that even people like Magneto recognize, that's huge. Especially given, you know, his opinion towards humans. It's just another reminder that we can be that too.
Num, in the way that your favorite characters are Storm and Emma, right? Emma's your other great love.
Storm and Jean and then Emma. Yes.
Storm and Jean and Emma. Kitty is Carrie's. Carrie loves Kitty more than anything. Carrie grew up dreaming of Kitty Pryde being her girlfriend. Like,
yes, I did.
So, Num, are you a Kitty Pryde fan?
I love Kitty. I grew to love Kitty through the dynamic of her and Aurora's relationship. This sort of like, you know, motherly, but also friends.
Yeah.
Kind of like protective. I get that a lot as a teacher. Like, I feel very protective of my kids too. So like, I get that. And of course, like, when she first joins the X-Men, like, Aurora is one of the X-Men that, like, is there for her and goes through a lot. But I love Kitty. I grew to love her more through, like, animated series and then getting back into the comics. I love to see her kind of constant transitions. I think that's been a thing for Kitty.
So. I like Kitty, too. I'm actually a pretty big Kitty Pryde fan. She's not in, like, my top favorites. Carrie and I got to do an episode all about Kitty's parents. science, which is interesting. And Kitty's dad ties to Professor X's past, which is one of those areas that I get obsessed with. Kitty is a character that we get to watch grow up. And one of the things I love most about her is the complex intersectionality of I'm a mutant, I'm a child of divorced parents, I am a Jewish person. And, you know, again, Kitty doesn't care what you look like. She just loves you. I love that we get to see her be awkward and uncomfortable and weird. And she's the mascot in a way that Jubilee later becomes the mascot in some ways. But she's also become a very competent woman. She has a deep, weak spot for any boy named Peter, no matter how toxic they are. I love her very much. Carrie, you have to keep this to less than three paragraphs. What do you love about Kitty Pryde? No symposiums allowed.
Let me get my note. I think you've both touched on a lot of it. It's that Kitty is, in a lot of ways, unremarkable, which makes her remarkable. It's a world, and I came to comics back in the 80s. You know, there was one woman in most superhero teams, and she was spectacular somehow. She was a goddess. She was the strongest mutant ever. She was a princess. She was an empress. And she was ultra capable, except when the men showed up, and then she went, oh no, what do we do? And like, I didn't want to be that. All of my friends used to get angry at me because I would be Princess Leia and I would save myself. For me, Kitty broke all of those molds. That's a big part of what makes her special, is because ultimately she's not.
I like that idea that she's a normal girl. And there's a thing, I interviewed Bob McLeod once about the creation of the New Mutants, and he drew all of the New Mutants characters at the beginning to be kind of gangly and awkward with bad hairstyles and you know, awkward features. And then it's just like 2 years later where they just start drawing them all super hot. You know what I mean? Yeah. Kitty has, I think, that vibe where she's the awkward teen turned into the beautiful girl. I really like her a lot. When we consider the character of Kitty Pryde, I mentioned this is one of the pieces of intersectionality for her. The idea that she's a child of divorced parents. We don't get as much from her mom as we do from her dad, but her dad is a veteran who has a very complex backstory and isn't often used. He ends up in some of the later work making bad deals with criminals, and Kitty like lives with the shame of that for a long time. Then he dies on Genosha, even into the most recent Marauders series, is trying to lay her dad to rest in a lot of ways. When Kitty first gets into the X-Men, I think we have to see her as a character who has a lot of attachment issues, and she really imprints on Storm and Xavier and Peter in different ways. Logan later, of course, although that one's a little bit more hard fought. And then eventually she becomes a kick-ass ninja, right? But the character who's kind of that mother vibe for her outside of Storm is Stevie Hunter. And Steve is really interesting. I do not believe there is a real world comparison for Stevie, but Stevie's backstory is she's a black female ballerina, and she has relatively dark skin. She has textured hair. We often see her with cornrows or braids. She's a character who is just in love with life in a lot of ways, but she got badly injured and is unable to dance. And every once in a while, her leg will flare up and she kind of cries out in pain. And then she's got to be helped off to the side a little bit. She doesn't like being helpless, but she also has a history as a dancer, and just seeing her darker skin and her textured hair, I think, is one of the reasons we imprint. There were a lot of black female ballerina dancers back in the 1970s, but not very many when you compare it to white lady dancers, because that's just how it works back then and even still now. But if you look up dancers like Raven Wilkinson, Janet Collins, Deborah Austin, Virginia Johnson, Lorraine Graves in particular seems to have kind of a Stevie Hunter vibe. Karen Brown is another. We're not going to spend a lot of time there, but it is interesting to go back and consider what it means to have a character represented in this way.
I think it's really, really important both then and now to have characters of color with varying styles. When we talk about her hair and like the texture and the color of her skin and those kinds of things, I think it's so important because I think a lot of times, and this is a conversation that I see in my own community as a person of color, as a black person, where it's like we see the same hairstyles and we see like very light skinned people of color, light skinned black people. And so I think like when we talk about specifically like Stevie and then Cecilia Reyes and like these characters who rock the braids, rock the cornrows, have dark skin, I think it's so important.
Put on a bonnet when they go to sleep, right? Like all of that.
Like all of these things, right? We talk about like Storm's more updated hairstyles, and like that is aside because, you know, I'm rocking straight hair today. But that is that is a choice I've made. I think it's because so often we don't see people of color represented in real ways. So like having her look the way she does immediately for people is like, oh, that is something I can associate with. That's something that's familiar to me. That's important.
Stevie doesn't have a ton of appearances, but some of her appearances are really iconic. We're going to kind of go through her history a little bit quickly quickly, we'll pause on some of the more fun interchanges. So listeners, when you hear us reading, I will be playing Stevie Hunter today, which is a crime, but Num One has to play Storm. So whenever you hear Num One, it is Storm. And whenever you hear Carrie, it is Kitty, because this is the character that Stevie interacts with the most on the page. So Stevie Hunter shows up in X-Men 139, 140 for the first time. Kitty Pryde's been here for around a year. She's in ninth grade, it states. It's November 1980, and Chris Claremont and John Byrne are her creators. Kitty is being taken by Storm into a dance studio into Salem Center, New York. Now later, Stevie's going to become like a full-time dance teacher at the Xavier Academy, which that job, she needs better job security is all I'm saying. But here she has a studio, and on her way up the stairs, Kitty states out loud,
"I'm a certified genius, you know. I'm taking college-level courses academically. Dancing is how I balance the scales. I can't make my body grow any faster, and my intellect isn't much good at helping me perform the moves right. But here, I'm just like everybody else. I can relate to kids my own age as equals. Boy, it's nice to be able to do that."
And I think most dancers out there can relate to this in some way, right? We feel a certain way around people who share our interests, that place where you can kind of shut off a little bit. Although Kitty wanting to grow cracks me up, because I'm just picturing her in front of her mirror at home doing that, I must increase my bust exercise, right? It's like dancing is the place where she gets it. So Storm says,
"Well, kitten, we've arrived.
I don't believe this. I'm so nervous."
And she meets Stevie Hunter, who has her hair in tight braids. There's golden beads woven in. She has a black leotard, thigh-high gold boots. She's stretching out on the balance beam and says, "Afternoon, folks. You're right on time. I'm Stevie Hunter. Welcome to my studio. And you must be Ms. Monroe and Ms. Pride from Professor Xavier's school, right?"
"I am Aurora."
"I'm Kitty. Kitty Pride. I'm your new student. I'm real pleased to meet you, Ms. Hunter. I saw you dance in Chicago before your accident. You were wonderful."
"Thank you. And the name's Stevie. Some iced tea, anyone?" So we jump to the next issue. Kitty is leaving dance class. She's in yellow fringe. A Star of David is around her neck. Stevie has on a black dress, blue jacket, and blue heel boots. And Storm notes that they are getting along famously. She's getting a little jealous. And Storm thinks to herself,
"Shouldn't bother me, but it does. I've been on edge since the moment we met. I keep telling myself such feelings are absurd. Stevie's one of the nicest women I've ever met. Yet, the feelings remain."
Kitty sees Storm and says,
"Hi, Aurora. Boy, you should have stuck around to watch the class. It was great."
And by the way, this is not Hi, Aurora. It's Hiya, Roro. It's R-O-R-O, like a little kitty pet name. It's cute. Stevie says, "Our kitten has real talent, Aurora. Once we smooth down her considerable rough edges," and Storm thinks,
"Our kitten?"
Stevie says, "Can I interest you both in a bite to eat? After a day teaching budding Baryshnikovs and Marikovas, which are real dancers, I'm famished." Aurora says,
"Thank you, Stevie. But no, we must be getting back to the school."
"Sorry, Stevie. Duty calls. See ya."
Some other time, perhaps. And Stevie just wants to be friends, and Aurora is not feeling it.
It's like, this is the dynamic that I was talking about, like, as, like, being, like, territorial almost. It's not a real thing. Like, my brain recognizes, okay, like, they can be friendly with my kids, like, they can be friendly with, like, my people. Like, it's the jealousy in the sense of, like, territorialism and, like, protectiveness, but it's not a real thing.
I love seeing Aurora Monroe be petty. It makes me happy every time that happens.
It's so petty, but, like, at the same time, it's not because she doesn't want Kitty to have other friends. It's because she's like, I feel like my space is being
included. You almost wonder, and Num One, I'd like to hear your opinion on this. You almost wonder if Storm has particular feelings because Stevie's another woman of color. Do you feel like there's some complex reactions there?
I mean, there might be a little bit. I mean, anytime you get people that are very well aligned or very similar together, there is that kind of clashing because of similarity. Stevie's a mentor for Kitty. Stevie's another Black woman. Stevie's very confident in herself, knows who she is. You know, Stevie is not afraid of, you know, being who she is. And so Aurora feels like, this person is also very similar to me because Aurora knows herself very well. So I definitely think that... that does come into play.
So for our gay listeners, think this through. You make that like one, for my gay male listeners, you make that like one straight girlfriend that you love and imprint on, and you just are her everything. And then one day she brings another gay boy around that's a little bit more flamboyant than you, and you have feelings about it. This is what colonialism does to our brains in a lot of ways, where we have these kind of layered identities, I think, a little bit, where we automatically apply preference to a certain thing. thing, and we don't want to represent our entire sex or race or gender or anything, but you kind of end up doing it, and then you play those games out in your brain without meaning to. You almost wonder if like America's getting to storm just a little bit here, which is a rough thing to consider.
I think what you just said also went for being the one bisexual female in the 90s. It was the exact same thing. I had flashbacks. But the other thing is that like I come to this as I was the dancer like Kitty. And then later on in my career, I injured my knee like Stevie and can't do it anymore. And so there is this, you know, she's so accepting, Stevie is, of what's going on. And this is Kitty's happy place. And for Stevie, like the fact that she's able to put aside the fact that this is something that she wants and can no longer have and try to instill that in her students. Gosh, I respect her.
And that piece of these characters is really interesting to me as well. I think if we had the right writer exploring that, there'd be like a really fun, you know how they do those like pride anthologies or like when they do it like for Black History Month, having someone write a story that explores Storm and Stevie's early relationship and how they kind of came to terms with each other, written by like Stephanie Williams, of course, right? Like something like that, I think would be a fascinating story. Throw Misty Knight in there. Like Jean Grey and Misty Knight there's some really interesting dynamics. Okay, we jump to X-Men 145 and 146. At the invitation of Kitty Pryde, Stevie puts on a pink and white dress, and with Storm in gold and black, they go to see the Royal Ballet at the Lincoln Center. And Storm says,
"The dancing is beautiful.
The beauty is the result of years of hard work and pain. It's a hard life, Aurora, a cruel one, and I'd give my soul to be part of it again." And Storm finds herself wanting to be like Stevie. Then Miss Locke enters and sedates Stevie and Storm with poison and apprehends them for arcade. And then Stevie finds herself a captive next to Candy Southern, Amanda Sefton, Jean Grey's parents, the Moira McTaggart, and Stevie is defiant even with Miss Locke like pointing at a gun at her head, and the X-Men have to rescue them. So Stevie ends up being one of those like long, oh, here's all the supporting cast. We're going to put them all in traps. But Claremont does it so well. The dedication Stevie feels toward being a dancer and the grief she has, even with like the PTSD of it all, I think this is something anyone I've ever known who is a dancer professionally particularly can relate to. Because you know you have a short shelf life. You know your career is not going to be long unless you reinvent yourself. And the wrong injury changes everything. Years of work, just grueling, grueling, grading work, and advancing up the ranks only to have one twisted knee away from having it all end.
I think it's handled really well in that it's not the sort of thing that only pops up when it's convenient. You know, I miss dancing every day, and it's been 30 years since I washed out, and that was it. There's also the, you know, which we'll kind of get to, the fact that it physically affects her and not just when it's convenient. You know, it's the sort of thing that is present all the time, and I think they handle that really well.
I mentioned earlier, I love when Storm gets petty. I also love when Storm gets horny. I also love when Storm has to take a day off. If we think of Storm as like Beyonce, this is the person who's like, yeah, I know you've been like traveling around the universe, like shooting lightning at people, but like come sit down and spend an evening at the ballet, please. Like we're gonna calm down for a minute. And I always love those moments for Storm in particular for some reason. And I think this is like what Storm and Wolverine understand about each other, which is why I get when they fuck and then they end it, right? Numbun, did you see that recent issue by Moriwa Ayodele where Storm fucks Wolverine and then like leaves him behind? So good.
I can't believe that's a question. Obviously, I'm like religiously reading this series. It's the best Storm series
ever. It's so good. It's so good.
I would go on like a full like sermon on Sunday about these issues so far. The last one that just came out actually is honestly one of the greatest comics I've ever read.
Mireille is writing Storm as though she's like a mythological god. Like it's legend.
It's so good. And when we talk about like connecting her to like all of like back history and like all of these issues and things, he's doing amazing work. I cannot speak highly enough of it.
I've got an upcoming Storm episode, Numun, where my guests are Mireille and Jed McKay, who's writing Storm and Avengers. So it's like the two current Storm writers together. I'm really excited about it.
And I'm gonna just faint and then get up like Jean Grey. But no, in all seriousness, it's so good. And I think the humanization of her, I think a lot of people miss because she is so powerful and because she's always like, I'm a goddess. And so people are like, yeah, she's a goddess. But they forget like the human part of her that can be petty, that can be like shallow and make poor decisions.
Marewa recently did that issue where Storm having dinner with Dr. Doom. And there's like full page of like Storm in lingerie and then Storm in a dress. The juxtaposition of Storm as like a little girl learning lessons from her dad and then like adult Storm reuniting with her dad's soul. Like, God, it's so good. Marewa, if you're listening, so good. We love you. So brilliant job. Keep it up, my friend. We're going to jump to Uncanny X-Men number 148. She is gorgeous in a frilled, like sleeveless purple. She attends a party with Jessica Drew and Storm and Kitty, and they're all dolled up. And then Dazzler invites them out to a nightclub, and Storm and Stevie have to remind Kitty to tone down her exuberance, which means go take your Adderall, girl. Dazzler performs. Caliban attacks because he tries to kidnap Kitty because he wants to marry her. That's a whole story. The crowd goes crazy. We jump to 152, where there's a giant X-Men adventure, and Storm ends up having her mind and body and powers swapped with Emma Frost of the Hellfire Club. It's problematic. There's some rough parts of this story. This is before we love Emma, like in a lot of ways. Storm is in Emma Frost's body and reaches out to Stevie Hunter telepathically, asking for help for her and Kitty, and Stevie comes to give them a ride. And she says, when a voice pops into your head and says, come a running, it's kind of hard to ignore it. Storm gives Stevie some instructions on how to handle the crisis if they don't come back. Kitty gives her a hug and says,
bye, Stevie. Thanks for standing by us.
Frankly, kiddo, your life scares the beans out of me, but you're friends, and I stand by those I love no matter what. And Storm thinks,
Kitty's feelings are strong for Stevie as for me. Stevie is an extraordinary person. I'm proud to call her my friend, yet I'm still jealous of that bond between them. Possessing Emma Frost's telepathic talent and being able to sense their thoughts and emotions only makes things worse. It's unfair to Stevie, unworthy of me, yet I can't help myself. I've come to think of Kitty as my own child. I resent having to share her.
And then as they depart, Sebastian Shaw and Emma in Storm's body throw Stevie's car aside and like force her to tell them everything. So Stevie is like in love with the X-Men. Like, she loves this little world that she's part of. Maybe it gives her like a little sense of adventure, but also she's been kidnapped by the evil Miss Locke, put in a cage by Arcade, and now like had Emma Frost and Sebastian Shaw like threaten to beat her up. She's going through some things here. Carrie, what are Stevie's thoughts on the mutant world at this point?
She never really seems to question whether or not she should be there, whether or not she has a right to hang or to occupy this space. For me, I think the interesting thing is that Kitty seems to be oblivious to all of this. Like, she's oblivious to the tension between Storm and Stevie. She's just thrilled. She's got two people that she loves more than just about anybody else in her life, and they're in the same place, and this is great. And I think Stevie wants to preserve that, and I'm pretty sure Storm does too. Like, they don't want to ruin this for her.
Yeah. Stevie's also a really fucking tough teacher. In 154, we see Kitty like practicing hardcore for a performance. In 165, we see Stevie get a pool day with Moira McTaggart and Ilyana Rasputina, which is a bizarre combination. These three, I would read a story about these three interacting at the pool, which is delightful. They're at the Xavier Mansion. The X-Men have been missing for weeks. Charles has depression. Stevie says, I can relate. And she, quote, she says, I feel something of the same sense of loss whenever I go to the ballet, and that same desperate willingness to pay any price to return to what I was. It's not an easy thing to cope with. Then she stands up and a spasm hits her knee. She falls back in pain. A tear runs down her cheek. She says, I was in an accident years ago, shattered my knee. Docs fixed it virtually good as new. I can walk. I can even dance a little in class. The only thing I can't do is perform. No great loss, I suppose. No worse than losing your soul. Okay, fellow creatives, you have this thing that you understand. I hear writers say things like this all the time. Like, I am miserable when I'm writing. The only thing that makes me more miserable is not writing. When my oldest son was born, I stopped performing, which is one of the reasons making this show is such a joy for me, because I gave up acting. I was doing improv comedy. I was in plays and musicals. And I still, all these years later, I haven't been in any sort of production. But when I attend a show where I can see people loving what they're doing on stage, I will weep every time. My husband still doesn't understand it. Like, he's like, why are you crying at this? And I'm like, because they love what they're doing. And writing gives me that same energy. Carrie, do you want to speak to that about what it's like to suffer loss when you You just want to do the thing that you do and do it well and have people notice.
Yeah, I absolutely relate to what you're saying. I cry at everything. I cry at dance shows. I cry when books are great. I cry at movies. I cry at cosplay. You know, like for me, not being able to dance is a big part of the reason why I'm now a professional writer, because it's that same act of sharing yourself with the world and that same act of creation. And well, I think they capture it really
well. I'm going to invite you to delve into that for just a second. Draw a comparison for me. What is it? What are the parts of you that come alive dancing that also come alive writing?
It's the stuff that you don't say to people. You know, you don't want to overshare. You don't want to take up too much space. You don't want to burden. You don't want to trauma dump. But this is a safe way to do those things and to show truth that maybe you would hide otherwise in yeah. casual conversation.
I think, and I do a lot of this exploration in therapy with people. I think these answers when we ask them of ourselves, or these questions, I think are really important. We can make it really deeply spiritual and complex, but we can also just rely on the fact that I feel better when I do it and I don't feel better when I don't. Num, can you relate to this as a creative person?
A lot of this, yeah. I feel like I kind of oscillate between like being like needing to create something and then needing to like take a break. But like when I'm taking a break, I'm like, I feel like I'm not doing anything. I feel this like almost like an itch. And it's been really hard because I'm trying to like navigate the creative spaces, like what I want to pour my creative energy into. But sometimes like I feel very overwhelmed. So like when I stop creating, I'm like, the world is not right. I should be doing something right now. Like I'm supposed to be doing something. And then when I am creating, like I feel almost like nothing else exists. So yes. It's weird for me. I don't ever feel like there's a time where like when I'm not creating. So like I can't I don't associate so much with the loss of it as much as like I know I need to be doing something. And so for me, it's more of like taking the time to actually create something and then also giving myself the space to like step away from it and let it exist as what it is.
There's a lot of people that I've befriended through the show who I think can intimately understand this. We watch a lot of sports movies about like a person getting an injury and then like having to kind of build their way back up. The other day, I'll have to check with this person to make sure they're okay with me sharing this story. Some of my favorite people and dearest friends here in Utah are X-Men artist Philip Seavey and writer Christy Porter. They're partners. They're wonderful. We watched Burlesque the other day and Philip got like really emotional during the film and turned to our group and said, "You guys, this movie is my Rudy." Rudy is that story where you just like make it happen, right? And Burlesque is not a great film, but Christina Aguilera's character is like, she just has this one dream and she will stay there as long as she can and advocate for herself as much as she can to fit. And we get it, right? Another person I'll have to check with to make sure it's okay to say this. My dear friend, Taylor Vessel, who's often on this show with me. Taylor is someone who is like, I've got a podcast, I've got to write, I've got to do something. This energy won't leave me alone. And then he'll get like very overwhelmed and like overstacked by it all. And then put the pressure on to do it again. This is a thing we go through. And I think Stevie is a character that we understand intimately for that reason. It's a little therapeutic when we connect with these characters this way. Yeah. Okay, we're going to cover a bunch at once really quickly. Marvel graphic novel number 5, which is the first appearance of the New Mutants. Stevie's dance studio is stated to be at 73 Willingdon Road, next to the Book Nook. During one of her classes, Ilyana Rasputina, who is now attending classes, sees Kitty get into a fight with a kid named Danny. Just as Colossus is arriving, Stevie says, "What the hell is going on here?" Turns out Danny is a huge anti-mutant bigot, but Stevie is upset with Kitty. We're going to talk about this scene. "With your training, you could have crippled Danny, or worse.
You'd have done the same to me, I bet.
Come on, let's get you inside and cleaned up."
"How can you all be so calm? Didn't you hear what he said?"
"They're only words, child." Kitty screams in Stevie's face before running away. Stevie's smile changes from a smile to shock. And I will not say this word, because this is a word we see used in comics in the 80s a little bit. Kitty says the phrase, "Suppose he called me an N-word lover." Very uncomfortable. "Suppose he called me an N-word lover, Stevie. Would you be so damn tolerant then?" Carrie, I said that so you didn't have to.
Oh, thank you.
Stevie then says, "You and your sister had better go after her, Peters. See she gets home safe. I'll speak to Danny and make certain this sort of thing never happens again." Colossus then says, and Num, do you want to read Colossus?
"Kitty is upset, Stevie. She did not think about what she was saying. She did not mean.
And Stevie starts to cry. Of course she did, my friend. She meant every word. And she was right. And she has no idea that there's some bigots around the corner with guns, literally ready to kill Stevie because she is a mutie lover. Okay, these comparisons, we love the real world comparisons, but when we see it put on the page written by Claremont and we equate it with racism and put the N-word on the page, it's a little too far for me. And Claremont does this in God Loves, Man Kills and in a couple of other places. Now, we will defer to you as a person of color, unless you want to pass completely. What's Stevie going through in this moment?
So I think, and for me as a reader, like, it's also really hard because, like, obviously, like, love Kitty. And like, this is one of those moments where, like, I choose to set this aside from who the character is and what the characters, you know, represents. I do think that it's really hard because anytime we have conversation about race and racism, racial slurs, any of these kinds of conversations, it's very jarring, right? And it's very unexpected, especially coming from people that you love. In this scenario, Stevie loves Kitty. This kid means a lot to her. And she is looking out for her in a time and in a space where she knows what this is like as a person of color. Yes, Danny was being awful to her. But Kitty, you know that you cannot stoop to his level. Also, you could have really hurt this boy because you are way more skilled than he is.
But let's divide this up into three things for just a moment. Number one, Kitty as a Jewish person, the descendant of Holocaust survivors, and as a mutant who is frequently attacked for being who she is defending herself against a bigot who's threatening violence. Number two, Kitty is a trained operative who, if her powers or her training go out of control, she can literally kill someone. And number three, Stevie is a woman of color trying to teach a class where she welcomes anyone but has rules for how we treat each other in there. So Kitty is Stevie's student and Stevie knows what Kitty's capable of. So there's some different layers to this before we even talk about the racism comparison.
Before we even get to that, and like so much of it does, like, it's all rooted back to that, being her being Jewish, her being also a mutant, her being a woman, you know, all of these layers, all of these, you know, different things compound into what makes Kitty who she is. Yes, you are facing discrimination in this moment, but, you know, MLK it, you know, Michelle Obama it, whatever you want to call it, like, now, you have to make sure that you are better. And coming from a woman of color as well, it's important because we know as Black people, like, we have to be better. We don't have an option. So it's very hard for Kitty to hear. It's very hard for Stevie to explain, but also it doesn't negate the fact that, yes, things were said. I'll address it. Like, I'll handle it. Like, that's a teacher in me. If someone does something in my class, I'll handle it. I know that you're hurt, but I'll handle it because I'm able to navigate this space in a healthy way.
Kitty is very vulnerable here, and she had a teacher come down on her, and Kitty's, like, inner child is reacting. There, we talk about intersectionality here quite a bit. There's something that happens, and I see it happen all the time as a therapist, where, or as a gay man in society, where people feel like they can be tougher on me. Like, their expectations of me are more. That bigot who screamed in my face, that was fine. But if you scream back, there's a problem, right? Like, that type of thing feels very heavy. But when someone comes around and says, I can't believe you didn't have compassion for me, Chad. I'm going through a divorce, and I thought you would understand what it's like to go through a hard time because you're a gay person. Wait, what? That doesn't equate. And so Kitty immediately turning it on, like, Stevie, how dare you not have compassion? You are a person of color. You should understand what it's like to be hated. And then I'm going to storm off. Ooh, like, if you had just said, you hurt my feelings, I get it, but don't turn it there. Don't take it there. You can't do that as a white person in this country.
But even, like, even if she wasn't a white person, I think that she's missing what Stevie was trying to do. Stevie wasn't trying to protect Danny. Stevie was trying to protect Kitty. And I think a lot of times too, like, we say these things without actually understanding. This person knows exactly what's going on. They're very aware. They get it. I think Kitty misunderstood her intention. Like, you don't get it, you know, but you should because of this. And Stevie's like, I do get it, but I get it in the sense of, like, I'm trying to save you and protect you and not give him another reason, right? To, like, prove him right. Like, I'm trying to.
And this is a smart part of Claremont's writing in that it gives us, this wasn't his intention, I don't think, but it gives us the piece to chew on. I'm sorry, is Stevie repeating to Kitty things that she has been told in her own life? You are a Black ballerina and you have to hold yourself to an extremely high standard because anything you do wrong, they will cut you for. Like, yes, you're better than them, but you have to be better than them. Like, you have to be at the top of your game all the time. And the pressure that we put on ourselves in minority groups, right? Stevie sees that in Kitty in a way. There's some pressure there as well. Carrie, do you want to talk about that at all? We're recording this in fucking Trump America and both of us are parents of queer children. word. Like, ugh.
Yeah. Well, and you know, when I read this section, it's a weird thing because on one hand, you know, approaching it from a writer's point of view, I want to show Kitty being a teenager. She's young. She's idealistic. She makes mistakes. She's very emotional right now. And this is a teaching moment. But how far do you take that moment? I think there's a real impeccable balance here where taking it further kind of undoes the work that you're trying to do, if that makes sense.
So we're on this same channel this month. I have Molly Laser and Daryl Lawrence on. We just recorded it. It'll be out right before this. We do an episode on the character Psycho Man, who's a weird FF villain. There's a John Byrne story in the 80s where Psycho Man is tapping into hatred in America and like causing race violence to happen with his like little like computer. It's rough. He's an alien character. You can see what the writers are trying to do because in one page it uses this phrase again, N-word lover, which is weird that Stevie's coming out right after this. That was not the through line here, I promise. Well, it just happened schedule-wise. But then they like beat a white preacher to death on like the next page. And then like you can see what they're trying to do, but this was a time in comics in the 80s where they're pushing that a little too much and it's white writers doing it every time. So we can look for the depth in it, but it's really uncomfortable. Write Kitty as a teenager, but don't put the N-word on the page for any reason at any time. It's never going to be all right unless you are a person of color and you have license to do that type of story.
I would also like to note, like in these spaces where we're having these writers and putting them within context of the time that they're written, I think also we understand now that we should be like collaborating with people of color, like in these scenarios and writing these stories and not being afraid to address them, but also being like, let me, you know, work with my peers, people who are experiencing this. Not the case when these are written, but I understand the intent.
Yes. And that's been a through line on this show right from the beginning. I'm not going to call someone racist unless it's very clear that there's a problem, but we can say that this person was well-meaning. It was of a particular time and it's still problematic for these reasons. There's some meat here in these conversations. I'm really pleased to have this safe space to talk to you both. So thank you. I hope you're both feeling safe. That's my hope. Stevie attends a surprise party for Kitty in one issue. In New Mutants number one, she kind of becomes a member of the supporting cast. She meets Juan and Roberto and Danielle and Sam and Rain. There's a scene where she's washing Karma's hair in the sink, drawn by Bob the Cloud. I think it's so adorable. And Danny is like projecting Shan's origins astrally. And Shan like leaps on Danny to choke her in a moment of anger because this is a girl who like has been through some shit, you guys. Shan has one of the deepest trauma backgrounds of any X-Men character. And Ilyana's right there. Stevie tries to stop her. So Swan possesses Stevie. Roberto slaps her. Anyway, that's page four. In the next issue, we see Stevie take the New Mutants to the mall for ice cream. But when she checks to see if Danielle is okay on the way back to school, she ends up getting grabbed by Michael Rossi, the old boyfriend of Carol Danvers, who apparently Stevie has met before. And he's there to warn them about Sentinels attacking, being activated by Project Wide Awake. So Stevie like helps the mutants because they literally are attacking the mall, right? It's one of those old Sentinels in the mall kinds of scenes. But she's in like way over her fucking head here, of course. These are death robots. And in the end, Rossi has Karma possess the bureaucrat John Ogilvy and forces him to confess to his crimes, which is mind control, right? Of course. So back at the mansion, Danny gets attacked by something that seems to be the Brood, the same aliens that kidnapped the X-Men. Anyway, Stevie's going through some stuff. Like the world of mutants is getting complicated. But we're going to cover one more and then we'll pause. In Uncanny X-Men 168, Stevie is teaching a grumpy Kitty Pryde in dance class. Ilyana Rasputina is there sitting on the side. And Stevie says, do you want to read Stevie in this section, Num?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Kitty, it would help if you stayed on beat. That's what it's there for. Done this piece before, Kitty. It isn't that difficult, but you've botched it every time today. What's ailing you, girl?
Oh, we're getting to hear Num's teacher voice because there's that thing where the student is capable of better and you know it and you got to support, but goddamn it, do your work.
Every time.
I'm trying, Stevie, okay?
Yeah, trying too bloody hard. Dance is hard work, but it's also supposed to be fun. Relax, kitten. Blow with the music and the movement. Don't fight.
Num, you went just a little southern there. It's cute.
I'm in a fighting mood.
Want to head over to the high school, put some gloves on, and spar a few rounds?
Darn, why am I yelling at you? It isn't you I'm mad at.
Is being an X-Men that important to you? you.
What I am, Stevie, where I belong. We're a family, don't you see? The X-Men are as close to me as my own parents. In some ways, closer. But by shifting me to New Mutants, the professor's saying that isn't so. It's tearing me up inside, Stevie. I don't know anymore what to do.
Resolve it, kiddo. One way or another, at the moment, you're no good to yourself or anyone else.
Jesus, great. How?
Charles isn't an unreasonable man. If you present a strong enough case, he's sure to change his mind.
Don't bet on it.
You want to feel sorry for yourself, Pride? Then do it somewhere else. I got no time for this. Life is lousy. No argument there. What matters is how you cope with it. Take your anger and do something constructive with it. Fight for what you believe in. Prove your case.
And Kitty does, and it works. And she gets to stay with the X-Men as a result. I love Stevie as the coach here. Like, I love you. I'm here for you. Now get up and do your dance.
That is something I can relate to.
Yeah. Carrie, do you have thoughts on Stevie's connection to the New Mutants?
You know, it's interesting that they picked her out of all of the characters to kind of be the adult in the room, because, you know, for the simple fact that she's not a mutant. And if you look at all of the, like, a lot of the human allies, they're love interests. You know, if you kind of look at the list of people, there are exceptions. But a lot of the humans in these comics are love interests. They're not people with responsibility. They're the ones who get saved, not the ones who are saving. And so putting her in with the new mutants says something about the direction that they're trying to take that team. And I really love it.
Also, the Xavier Mansion is a school. Kitty has been the only student for a long time. So now there's a whole team of people who are there. In New Mutants number 4, we get a story called What's Scary or Who's Scaring Stevie? And this is a really interesting Stevie Hunter story that shows her dedication to people. There's a message. Hi, Stevie. You know who this is. You know what I want. Soon I'll come and get it. So Stevie starts getting like really creepy phone calls and the police won't do anything about it. So I'm gonna cut through some of this quickly. There's a kid named Peter Bristow who's a kid in a local school. He's a redhead. He's a white kid. He's being abused by his dad. He is a child, but he has a crush on Stevie. So the New Mutants help track him down and Stevie drives a car into a building, endangers civilians, starts a fire, and defends herself with a stick through the course of this story. The kid ends up getting caught. He's a huge bully. He begs Stevie, don't tell my parents! But then he tries to attack Danny because she manifests his fears of his abusive dad. At his core, he feels like he's a terrible person. I'm a bad boy. I need to be punished. When I started dancing, Miss Hunter, I thought you were the most beautiful woman in the world. I couldn't help loving you. You said you liked me, but when you wouldn't punish me no matter what I did, I figured you were lying, that you really care, because if you loved me, you'd hit me. I'd want to get even. I'm sorry, Miss Hunter. I'm so sorry. And she hugs him and they both cry. But honestly, just fuck this kid. Really, truly. Really, truly awful. He's having like sexual fantasies about his dance teacher and like turns into a full stalker and tries to murder her in this story. Like, nope. During all of this, Stevie's knee acts up again and Xavier like says he'll get the kid help. I don't know. Does he get him in therapy? Does he put him in foster care? We've never seen him again. Maybe he joined Orcus later. I don't know. Crazy story. I'm going to jump to one more and then we'll talk about it. Stevie in number 5 accompanies the kids to see Team America perform. This is a group of motorcycle performers who, when they all join their minds together, form the Dark Rider. It's very Power Rangers, but 80s on motorcycles. We'll talk about them another time. I would love to do a Team America episode. Terrorists end up attacking the motorcycle rally, and the New Mutants rush to action, and Silver Samurai's here, and Viper's here, and they are scary, and Karma gets hurt, and Stevie at one moment gets this little speech.
That was a missile. It's like we're in a war. I'm a dancer, a teacher, not a superhero. This isn't my style at all.
And later when Xavier's using Cerebro to track the foes, Stevie thinks,
I know Xavier's a good man, but at times like this, I feel like I'm staring at a demon from Fantasia's Night on Bald Mountain. How can anyone wield such power and not be corrupted?
All right. Num, what are your thoughts on the Stevie-Peter Bristow relationship?
My worst nightmare as an educator.
Yes, the obsessed student. Woof.
My worst nightmare. No, I don't like it.
I'm a bad boy, Stevie, and I thought you loved me, but you won't hit me and spank me. What's wrong? I have to kill you now. It's really, truly terrible.
I don't like it.
Carrie, Marvel calls, and you get a 64-page annual, but you have to only write about the character Peter Bristow. Do you take the job?
Oh, how much retconning am I able to do?
This kid is a Hydra agent now. Like, there's no other life for him.
I mean, I guess if you can just flat out make him a villain, because that's what he is.
Yep. Num, again, you are welcome to pass this question. I know all women go through this to a particular extent, but white teenagers or white men fetishizing black women is also a huge problem in our culture. Woof. I don't know if you have any comments or not.
I think it's really just, it's something that we have to like navigate these spaces of, because so much history and things are involved in this.
Yeah, these are rough stories when we see them. Stevie is the hero here, but also she has to be rescued and she forgives him at the end, which is, I don't know. I like that for her, I suppose, because he's a kid. He's an abused kid and she sees that. If this kid were like 2 years older, if he was like 17 or 19, you're like, nope, fuck, get out. But like, he's forgiven, get it.
I think finding forgiveness, the Michelle Obama road, I'm bringing it back. Like, sure, I get it. But also, like, kid needs some serious help. And also, yeah, maybe, like, a mind wipe, Xavier. Maybe
if
that's
you haven't read maybe. New Mutants number 5 in the last 20 years, folks, go pick it up. You'll have some feelings. We're going to jump to Uncanny X-Men 177. In Stevie's study, Kitty confides that she's struggling because Storm has gotten a mohawk and she has gone punk. And Kitty is so upset. It's less about the mohawk and more about the changes Storm is going through internally. And now Kitty has to kind of grow up, and she's having her like divorced parents part of her like show up again here. Stevie says,
it's only a haircut, for goodness sakes, and a change of wardrobe. What's so terrible about that?
More, Stevie, you don't understand. She's changed on the inside as well.
We're not going to spend a lot of time there, but this is a big thing Kitty goes through for a minute, and the kid, get over it. Like, this is Stevie's approach sometimes. Like, stop making it about you. It's not about you at all. In New Mutants number 13, Stevie attends a barbecue with Xavier and the New Mutants, and she meets Magma for the first time, who has worn a formal gown to dinner, and she's like mildly racist and like wondering why the help isn't waiting on her. Like, Magma's a rough character. She grew up in like a Roman society with fucking Celine as her grandmother, right? Later, Stevie has a class. There's a group of students. Cannonball is so adorable in this issue. I love it. Rain changes into wolf form for a moment, and they all scold her because she's in public, and Stevie thinks,
Kitty and Rain are the flip sides of the same coin, each jealous because they see their place threatened by new arrivals, each of them so insecure. And the terrible irony is, they've no reason to be. Easy for me to say. The hard part's making them believe it.
I don't know if Kitty would enjoy being compared to Rain.
Nope.
In New Mutants 14, before they head off to vacation, Stevie helps the New Mutants go shopping at the mall. Belasco and Sim attack from Limbo, and there's a demon invasion. And Stevie helps pull Ilyana to safety at a key moment, leaves with her in an elevator, but she gets a fall and hurts her knee again. The pain's as bad as ever. The wrenching in my leg when I landed didn't help any. My knee won't lock into place. I'm completely useless. She also sees Ilyana's dark side. In 15, she's on vacation. We get to see her camping with the X-Men when they're telling stories in X-Men Annual 8. In New Mutants Annual 1, she's guiding Danielle Moonstar in a stretching routine, and Danny gets a Charlie horse in her thigh, and she gives her some tough love here, and I like this scene a lot, actually.
There's no law against crying. You don't have to prove to me how brave and tough you are.
Why is it taking so long to get better? I hate this.
You're lucky to be a lab girl.
No, Stevie, but sometimes it's so hard.
It was for me, too, when I was recovering from my broken knee.
How'd you stand it?
I screamed a lot. I cursed. I broke things. I cried. Mostly. I admit, when I was alone, I became a real beast. I tested my friendships to the limit and discovered who I could truly count on. But with their help, I fought. I got well. You mustn't bottle up your emotions, Danny. You have to give them release somehow, or you'll tear yourself apart inside. Take things one day, one step, one miracle.
I love this scene a lot, and it tells us a lot about Stevie. This is a conversation I have with folks in therapy a lot. We have particular moments in our life. The car gets hit, or you miss a step, or my mom had like a recent fall down the stairs in a moment, and like your whole fucking life is changed afterward, right? There's these little things that happen to us and it doesn't feel fair. And it changes. We grow through it though. So there's a point where I don't think Stevie would ever say, I'm so grateful I got injured. But you can say like, I'm a resilient person because of this injury. Like, this thing I went through is something I carry. And I like Stevie's toughness here. In New Mutants 38, Stevie's guiding Rain, Ilyana, Magma, and Doug in some choreography. She's being so tough on them, especially Rain. This choreography is nothing new. The moves should be second nature to you. you, and this time give it a decent try. But now Magneto comes in yelling, and Stevie just does not need this at this moment. When Ms. Hunter or I or any teacher in this school gives you an assignment, you will execute it to the very best of your ability. And Liana's like, I'm fucking out of here, and teleports away. And Stevie says,
what do you try next? Punching them out? This is my class, Magneto. And if you have no objections, I'd like to finish it without any more idiot reference. Idiot interference.
She called Magneto an idiot. Carrie, is this the Magneto moment you love?
Yes, to his face.
It's delicious.
The lady has stones. I'm gonna give her that. Seriously.
I can fucking handle it myself, Magneto. Like, I love it. In New Mutants 39, Danny quits the New Mutants. Stevie hugs her goodbye. Later, she, like, helps Magneto with Tom Corsi and Sharon Friedlander. And Magneto rants about how, like, Empath has been manipulating him. In New Mutants 43, the New Mutants return from vacation. And Stevie, who has just finished a workout in the pool, and she's in her black bathing suit, she immediately judges them. She makes Roberto in a suit practice first position and then second position. Your muscle tone is non-existent. And the rest of you layabouts aren't much better. It's going to take some hard work to get you back into condition. And then all the mutants are thinking, Stevie, slave driver, that's not a word that we needed to see. Give us a break. What is this, a prison? She never puts the X-Men through this kind of torture. Yeah, with them, she's tougher. But again, we didn't have to use that S word in this context. Just truly not necessary, white students. Like, we don't need to go there. In New Mutants 48, the New Mutants are missing. Stevie comes to work. Magneto has activated little widget robots, and she's so annoyed. I was here before you as faculty. And he's like, I am so sorry. I did not mean to mess up your day. We jump to Uncanny X-Men 270. Stevie is back after years, and she has a new red hairdo and like a red leather jacket, and she's helping an expanded team of X-Men evaluate their powers, including Storm, who is trapped in a child body thanks to Nanny. I love Nanny. Later, we get to see Stevie in a floral bikini. She is looking good. She's enjoying leisure time with the X-Men, but then the Genosian magistrate attack, and she is literally running for her life as machine gun fire hits the ground after her while carrying Storm, and then her knee gives out and Storm drops Stevie into a safety hatch onto Cable, and the Storm and the kids end up getting captured, and this is the beginning of the extinction agenda. So some key moments there for Stevie, who's back after a long time after years.
I personally love, and this goes back to my initial commentary, I love how she is like, okay, I'm in this, I'm gonna like save as many people as I can, I'm gonna fight as hard as I can, even though I'm not a superhuman, I'm still gonna do what I believe is right. And like, obviously, like initially when she starts here, she's like, I'm carrying this little girl who like I used to know as an adult, but like I'm gonna get her as far as safety as I can, and like even though like I know this may not end well for me, like I'm still gonna protect these kids. So I think that's really important.
So Stevie is full supporting character at this point. She is there when Colossus gets possessed by the Shadow King. She gets taken hostage by Mr. Sinister alongside Valerie Cooper. And this is not a woman I don't think Stevie would have much time for. And then she's like an X-Force where she's there when Cable shoots Sinister in the head so Stevie and Val can get away. She's in the X-Men infirmary in X-Force 17, and they fucking color her white on the page, which is such a bad problem. I hate it, but we'll go past it. X-Force 19, she's like helping Sunspot learn about his powers. She's there when Ilyana gets the legacy virus. She's there at Ilyana's funeral. She's there at the wedding of Scott and Jean. And then we finally get her in Uncanny X-Men Annual 18, where she's like very dark here and has like a very full head of hair, and she's teaching Kitty, who she leaves the studio for a bit, and Caliban kidnaps Kitty and she calls the X-Men. So I'm covering a whole bunch of her shit really quickly. She's not a huge character on the page for a long time. And then we get X-Men Gold number 9.
She is now a congresswoman.
She's a fucking congresswoman in New York. She gets to wear like pantsuits, and she is Congresswoman Stephanie Hunter. They don't let her go by Stevie. She has to go by Stephanie at work now.
It's very exciting. I love it.
Kitty is shocked.
Yeah, I guess you can't exactly check the news when you're trapped in a giant flying space bullet, but I ran in the Connecticut third round around this time.
Can't believe I didn't know. I am the worst friend ever.
It takes two to fall out of touch, kiddo.
And she invites Kitty and Peter to testify before Congress to address mutant rights, and Kitty gives this amazing testimony against a mutant segregation bill. They whiplash attacks. Stevie has to call later and says the bill's passing the Senate subcommittee. It's great to see this relationship between like two adult women who have like moved on and moved forward with their lives. He's at the bachelorette party for Kate in the X-Men The Wedding Special, and they're at Stripperoki, which is a stripper karaoke place. She's back in X-Men Gold number 30, and she's there helping Kitty do her makeup before the wedding. Let's read one more interchange.
I hate mascara almost as much as I hate makeup.
You're going to look beautiful, Kitty.
I don't know, Stevie. Having a United States congressman do my makeup feels a bit like overkill.
Are you planning on complaining this entire time?
Pretty much.
We also have a moment where Kitty has, she hugs her mother and Storm and Stevie all at the same time and says,
I'm here with the three women who raised me. Three strong, wonderful women.
And Stevie's hair here is so gorgeous, like wavy, frizzy curls. But later, Kitty does not go through with the wedding. She leaves Peter at the altar, and we're just not going to talk about it today. So Mark Guggenheim wrote this section of Kitty's history. I've interviewed Mark, and I've asked him. He just is really fond of Stevie, and he wanted to give her a big upgrade. What are our thoughts as Stevie, as a congresswoman?
I think it's actually really smart storytelling. She's so aware of that world and so aware of the good that the X-Men were trying to do, the good of, you know, the possibility of good of mutants, right? Even having seen Magneto transition from leading the Brotherhood to leading the X-Men, you know, when the New Mutants were there. I think she has a very strong conviction as well to protect these people in a way that is important, not just for the X-Men, but for like mutants in general. So I think joining Congress and being a part of United States government in that sense is the ability to do a lot of good. And I think she does it and she takes it seriously. So
it almost to me feels like a bit of a course correction. You know, you get this, there's this period where Stevie gets progressively more responsibility. She's gaining respect. She's calling Magneto out multiple times and not getting squished like a bug. And it feels like they're building to something. You know, she's becoming more important. She's becoming a full-fledged character. And then she just kind of goes away. You know, and it feels like there was some kind of internal change in direction because it feels like they're building up to something and then it just kind of goes poof. And this feels like almost a natural continuation of that.
Yeah,
We're coming back to that original intent.
So Stevie is seen as a congresswoman in Immortal Hulk 35 during the Zemnu the Titan stuff by Al Ewing. We see her in Ghost Rider, Wolverine, Weapons of Vengeance Alpha, where she sends a warning to the X-Men about Project Hellfire, which is the new Helverine story. We also see her in Dazzler number 4 by Jason Lowe, my dear friend. Stevie's dressed in like a gorgeous white pantsuit, and she and Luke Cage are like giving Dazzler a day in New York City and also fighting for mutant rights. I don't know that there has ever been a bad Stevie Hunter story. There's a few key moments with the character that like, I'm like, oh, why did they write it that way? But this is a character who's pretty resonant, mostly as the dance teacher, as Kitty's kind of mother figure. I would love to see more stories from her perspective.
I think for me, the biggest thing was when you asked me to do this, you know, to have this conversation, I thought, oh yeah, that's great. And I could only really remember a couple of moments. She's much more present than I ever really realized. And I think that's a testament to how much the moments that we do get really, really work. And they give us a part of the X-Men universe that we don't get to see very often on the page. And I'd love to see more stories where she and some of the other human allies get to actually stand up and take action. Because I think I mentioned in the past, like there are a long list of humans who have been in the X-Men comics, but almost like a large majority of the time, they're the love interest. And that's what they do. That's the purpose they serve in the story. And there are exceptions. There's the FBI agent, Fred. I was going to say Fred Durst. That's definitely
Fred,
not
Fred Duncan.
Fred Duncan. Yeah.
I am the only person in the world that has written full stories about Fred Duncan that I hope to put today.
Yeah. But, you know, even to see her ally with people like that who are interested in progressing mutant rights and standing up for what's right, but giving them a chance to take action, I'd love to see that. Helps inspire those of us who want to be allies, you know, showing that work, I think would be great to give it space on the page.
It's funny because, like, I didn't really feel like I related to her as much, but after going through all of this and, like, seeing, you know, her transition through everything, I feel like I do, honestly, like, on a realistic level, relate to her a lot. It's nice to see someone who, like, is about doing what's right, but also, like, protecting these kids in the sense of, like, normalcy, like, outside of them just being mutants or outside of them being superheroes, like, recognizing these are kids, like, they need normalcy, they need structure, they need support. I honestly would love to see her. I think Havoc is doing X-Factor right now, and they're working with the government, in a sense, I'd love to see her like in that sphere, like navigating all of that and sort of like being a mentor in the sense of like protecting mutants in this team and like making sure like any mutants that they bring in it are, you know, taken care of. I think that would be a really great spot for her because it's dealing with a mutant team with the government oversight within government, you know, work and spaces. I think it'd be really smart to have her come up there and actually like interact with a lot of characters who also maybe she hasn't really interacted with.
I think everything I want to see about this character we could find in one story, but I think she needs to be the focus. I think she deserves an issue of X-Men sometime. And I think the easy premise is that she and Kitty have a moment where they are, you know how Claremont would take that character like Charlotte Jones and put them in like a really dangerous situation, Lindsay McCabe, like make them fight for their life and like they are gonna get killed, but they somehow survive. I think Stevie needs that kind of story where she gets the moment to save the day. So she and Kitty are trapped in some sort of situation and we get a lot of flashbacks to her past. We have never seen her childhood, her parents. We've never seen a love interest. We've never seen her actual accident. We've only seen it referenced. We see her dancing. We see her interactions with some of the early team as she becomes more aware of the world of mutants. We see her reference that time that little white kid stalked her. We see her like run for Congress. We see her in a story where she is in a difficult situation on a political level and she has to make the right decision and she stands to lose everything as a result. I think there's a ton of stuff to explore with her. I think she could be a main character in a book, but it has to be written by the right person. I think a person who is fond of Stevie can write that, but I really think this woman deserves to be written by women of color. Stephanie Williams, give us an epic Stevie Hunter story someday, please. Justina Ireland would write an amazing Stevie Hunter. I think there's a lot about her. The piece of her that I relate to most is the artist, right? Like that part. This character has done no wrong. That's what I'm realizing as we are kind of wrapping up our thoughts here. Any final thoughts or questions about Stevie Hunter?
I was thinking too, because Kitty right now is working with Emma in Extraordinary X-Men with a bunch of young mutants too. I think that that would be a great spot for her to kind of like support. But of course, like if we want her to be like a main focus, I feel like she would take a back seat to both Emma and Kitty in that sense. But that's just my own opinion.
Yeah, but sure. She's on her own too. I don't think this woman has any patience for Emma Frost.
Oh, not at all. But I think it would be good for her too because they're dealing with young mutants who need normalcy and who need, especially after what everything Kitty's been through with Orcus and Krakoa and everything. I think it would be good to bring someone back that can help her find her roots and find kind of solidity in being a mentor to these kids because we're such a great mentor for her.
Yeah, absolutely. I like her in that role. And I think we could put her in that like kind of mutant affairs role in the Congress and make that really interesting. I would love to see her interact with Storm more. I'd love to meet her mom. And you know what? Dawns on me, Stevie could be queer. Like there's no love interest ever. She could have a beautiful like partner on the side that we've just never met. Maybe she's been in a happy relationship for years. I think there's a lot to explore. Carrie, how are you feeling?
Yeah, actually, as Num was talking, I thought about how, you know, building on that idea, you know, if Stevie and Kitty are teaching together, that does really kind of bring everything full circle, given how Stevie was first introduced. You know, from the point of view of a Kitty super fan, I think out of all the people who could talk some sense into her, she and Stevie and Storm are the two biggest ones.
Yeah.
And I'd love to see a little more space on the page to show how that relationship grows and changes now that she is Kate and not Kitty. You know, everything has changed so much.
Stevie Hunter, I love. I could write this character all day. When I started, I was like really picturing out like, what is it I love about her? This conversation has solidified that. I think we hit her from most every angle and we got to cover the problematic stuff without like making it too heavy, which is the whole point of this show. So thank you everybody for sharing your voices, your stories, your thoughts. If you have any final thoughts, I'd love to hear them. We're going to put this out on March 26th. As we're wrapping up, do you guys have any final thoughts? Where can people find you online? And is there anything you'd like to plug? Let's go Num and then Carrie.
Hi everyone. My name is Num1. You can find me on Instagram under Num1XMNCosplay. By the time this is coming out, I will be gearing up for Awesome Con. I'm really excited to go back. Always super excited to see all the cosplayers out there. So see you guys there.
I'm Carrie Harris. You can find me at CarrieHarrisBooks.com. March or April, I've got a new Miraculous Ladybug book coming out. No more Marvel work currently, but I do have a couple of X-Men books out if you'd like to go back and check them out, featuring some of the lesser known characters in the X-Men universe, which are my
favorite. And where can people follow you, Carrie?
Let's see. Follow me at Carhar, C-A-R-R-H-A-R-R. at most, just about everywhere.
Wonderful, wonderful to see you both. Thank you for hanging out with me and bringing so much joy to my Sunday. I love you both. Over on the main show, we will be doing a script reading from Avengers 137, which is the issue where Beast joins the Avengers. It is a crazy time. And then in a couple weeks, we get to read the script to Champions number one, which I'm one as a part of, playing Virginal Venus. So good to see you both. Follow the show, GrayMalkin_Lane on Instagram. And thank you, everybody, for the ongoing support. I hope we are bringing light and joy to your nerd lives in this crazy political time. We'll see you all back here next time on the Gray Malkin Lane Patreon show. And now stay tuned for some thoughts on fascism as a special guest and I talk about a Red Skull story and its modern applications. Though publicly Hitler and his top aides saw Christianity as foolish and as a distraction from their more fascist ideals, and they even saw National Socialism, their name for Nazism, and Christianity as irreconcilable, Hitler also recognized that much of the German public identified as Christian, so at times he made some bizarre statements to try to win over the support of those he saw as Christian, as his power base built so that he could eventually transform things the way he saw. Always, Jews needed to be exterminated. But Christians, even though, by the way, Nazis saw Christianity as a derivation from Jewish faith, ultimately, Christians had to be tolerated. So at times, Nazi propaganda would discuss the idea that Jesus was an Aryan, a white savior who was heroic and an anti-Semitic figure who backed Aryan and Nazi causes. There's a literal place called the Institute for the Study and Eradication of Jewish Influence on German Church Life. They fostered the printing of new Bibles that simply removed the Old Testament from all publications. They called it Die Judenbuch, or the Jews' Book, and they rewrote sections of the New Testament to paint Jesus as a Nazi, anti-Jewish kind of warrior figure. In private, however, some of Hitler's top aides, like Heinrich Himmler, were actually promoting pagan Germanic ceremonies related to Nazism that believed in the ancient rites of the white Aryan race and its ties to the soil and blood. So there's this thing called the German Faith Movement, or the Deutschland Glaubensbewegung, and they promoted a new non-Christian spiritual system centered on this blood, soil, and ancestral heritage. So in private, Hitler's saying things to his aides like, quote, "The heaviest blow that ever struck humanity was the coming of Christianity," and "Christianity is a rebellion against natural law, a protest against nature." There were secret private plans to declare a national religion for Germany after the war that promoted Aryanism and Nazism. Now, there's a number of stories about Christians rising up against the Nazi cause, and I'm just going to share one, and you'll understand the relevance in today's story in just a moment. In 1943, there's a small town called Nowogródek in Poland, which is now in Belarus, I think, in modern maps. This town saw the Nazis wiping out all of their resistance and just literally executing people in the streets for standing against them, including the town's priest. There was a group of 11 Roman Catholic nuns stationed there in a place called the Congregation of the Sisters of the Holy Family of Nazareth. And they could have fled the scene when they were asked to. They had the opportunity to escape as religious kind of innocents, but they chose to stay and offer comfort and food and healing to the people who had been wounded, knowing that their lives were in danger. And as a result, a few days later, all 11 nuns were arrested on August 1st, 1943, taken out by the Gestapo into the woods, shot in the head, and dumped in a mass grave. 11 among the hundreds that died in this village, but these were remembered. They were killing innocent people, innocent nuns specifically. And in the year 2000, many years later, Pope John Paul II beatified the 11 sisters, naming them the Blessed Martyrs of Nowogródek. Let's jump to Captain America, 290 through 295. This is 1984 by J.M. DeMatteis and Ron Frenz, and it's the culmination of a very long story. In fact, our next several episodes on our Red Skull discussions are going to be all about this story specifically, but it's a huge preamble. It goes on for like 30 issues, and this is a big build. It's great. Helmut Zemo, you may recognize that guy from the Thunderbolts, his face horribly scarred after trying to live up to the legacy of his father, Nazi war criminal Heinrich Zemo, is
wearing a purple suit, a latex mask, and a blonde wig while scoping out Captain America and Nomad, Jack Monroe, the 1950s commie smasher Bucky, when Zemo is suddenly approached by a woman floating down from the sky in a black robe, cinched with gold braids around the waist, her legs bare, a flowing black cape behind her inlaid with blue. The shoulders come out into spikes. She has on a black skull cap, an ornate golden necklace, and black heels. She's like a sexy nun. Her hair and arms are covered, and frankly, it's a very cunty look, especially when she introduces herself. "Although I have taken many names over the years, you may call me Mother Superior." She pulls off Zemo's mask to see his melted face and promises to be his greatest friend. Later, we see Arnie Roth, who you may recognize from modern Anthony Oliveira stories, Captain America's friend from youth, a heroic veteran who is gay and Jewish, and he's having nightmares. The narrator says, "You stand alone in the graveyard, the mists caressing you like a smoky cerement. Your heart is torn by the sharp, nailed fingers of loneliness and grief. With all your heart, you wish your beloved was beside you again. Your wish is granted. Why then do you run?" And Arnie stands over the grave of his life partner, Michael, who just recently died, and his boyfriend rises out like a zombie with a shock of red hair. As the thing rises from the moist earth, its eyes reflect an obscene distortion of a love you once knew. It wants you, Arnold Roth. It wants you. And the zombie bites Arnie as he wakes up with a scream, only to find Baron Zemo, now in pink and purple and gold, and Mother Superior in his home. "The nightmares have not ended yet, Jew," says Zemo. They warn him that his death is near, and Mother Superior puts Roth back to sleep with a touch to his forehead. He later realizes that it wasn't a dream, they were really in his apartment. They're watching him from afar, and Mother Superior says she needs to go talk to her father. So they step inside a haunted house. This is the first appearance of Skull House, and Mother Superior asks Baron Zemo to speak to his father. "Papa, he was a great man, a brilliant and noble man. He served the fatherland with pride. He served his family with equal pride." And they walk in on an emaciated old man who's listening to Chopin's Funeral March. Listeners will recognize that. And Zemo recognizes him as the Red Skull. So jump forward, Mother Superior telepathically shows Zemo the history of human violence while also trying to unlock a particular hatred within him. The Red Skull says, "Vengeance is a dance that must be carefully choreographed. You begin with slow, graceful steps and then build to a climax of power and passion, of beating drums and animal frenzy." They end up capturing Captain America's ally, the pacifist Dave Cox, who is a veteran and a father and an amputee, and they mentally turn him into the Slayer, sending him after Cap and Nomad, and Cox ends up resisting Sin's or Mother Superior's control as she tries to drive him to violence. He collapses under the strain, lands into a coma to be resolved in a few issues, and then Mother Superior takes Zemo back to her church, where her sisters in sin are waiting. Sister Dream! Sister Pleasure, Sister Agony, Sister Death. Arnie Roth is kidnapped. The heroes fight the Sisters of Sin. They end up getting caught in a trap, and it's literally Nazism designed in the Nuns of Robes in this issue. This is a build I'm summing up a lot at once, and it continues into the next episode. Wow, okay, that was a lot. Let me welcome my very dear friend, Amanda Martini, to talk about this crazy fucking story. Amanda, are you a Red Skull fan?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. So just off the bat, one of the things that I loved about reading these issues is that it just, again, not to like back in my day, but like it just reminds me of the old things, because like this story, even though like it takes place over five issues, this is like the B story that's building that you know is going to go somewhere, because like you skipped over all of the A stories. Yeah. and in one of the comics that I read has nothing to do with any of these things.
Yeah, I kept the summary very focused on certain
things. Which again obviously makes sense, but like when I was reading, I was like, okay, I'm gonna start skimming because this has nothing to do with the Red Skull, so I have a feeling we're not gonna be talking about the Tumblr the Tumblr 2 and Black Crow. I'm like, I'm just gonna like move on ahead.
Black Crow ends up being a big part of this story, but to jump to the end of this, and listeners will follow along. Excuse me, the Red Skull is old. He's trying to leave a legacy behind. And he's got a daughter and he doesn't like her, so he wants the daughter of war criminal Baron Zemo as his, or the son of war criminal Baron Zemo as his heir instead. So he wants Captain America to suffer. He's talking about choreographing this big dance, and it's all leading to a huge culmination in a little bit.
Yeah, and at one point in the story when Mother Superior and Zemo are watching, so Jack, and also like Jack also has like the weird nightmares, which I'm assuming is going to play out in this as well. At one point, so Nomad, Sam Wilson, Falcon, Arnie Roth, and Captain America are all playing cards together at like 3 a.m. And Zemo's like, all of his friends are with him now, let's kill him now. And she's like, no. We have more things to do. And it's like, oh yeah, like the true slow build, like the bad guys are plotting kind of stuff, which is, in my opinion, is always more fun.
I truly wish this was the last Red Skull story ever written. He does die at the end of this, and it's a great ending for the character. But then, of course, he's back a few years later.
Well,
Okay, we got about 8 points to talk about, so I'm going to toss a few things at you. Number one, we
okay.
got to talk about the fashion of Mother Superior and the Sisters of Sin, because they're amazing.
I mean, it is like nun cunt personified, or like whore nun personified. Like it is, and also like each one has like their like little specialty or like little thing. I am a sucker for like a specialized team uniform. So like they all have like the black skull cap and like sort of like a black bodysuit in one way or another, and then like accessories to go with. Also, they give very female Furies of the DC universe, where it's like there's like the big one who's strong, there's the one who has claws, there's the one who has like the mental powers, which is just again a whole lot of fun. But yeah, the fashion, I mean, Mother Superior, she looks incredible. Again, I have come to realize that there is a strict no fascist cosplay policy, but Mother Superior and unfortunately Andrea Fenris, like they just have good looks, but they're horrible people. I just don't think it could ever.
So the interesting thing about these characters, we'll cover their origin in another episode to come shortly, but these are children. The Red Skull has a young daughter, and he like adopts some friends for her from an orphanage and then ages them all up to adulthood after brainwashing them.
When she arrived on in the script, I was like, Chet sent me a picture of her at least 6 months ago, telling me to like look into this hot ass mess.
We'll
So
get
no,
there. I
I'm down.
promise we'll get there. There's a list. Okay, so really fun superhero antics. There's a really fun supporting cast here. I fucking love Bernadette Rosenthal. I love
Oh yeah,
Superior.
Bert. So this is my first introduction to her.
Oh, I
I
love her.
so like I know, because I'm an X-Men girly, so like I know of other heroes, but like a lot of their supporting cast I don't know. So I had to Google her afterwards, and I was like, oh, she sounds fun.
She's
And
great.
also like in the so like she gets a couple of really good moments in this. But like Cap's like whole support thing, and the thing is, it's in an era where a supporting cast of a book was like really important. Like there needed to like be these non-superhero people that a character needed to have to like sort of flesh them out, like Arnie Roth and Bernie Rosenthal. But I also love that he takes her back to the Avengers mansion, and like they're kind of like flirty or whatever, and she's like, oh, there's a mosquito, go away mosquito. But no, it was the wasp. She was investigating who was making noise at like 3 a.m., which was great. I love that. But no, she just seems like super fun. And she's definitely like Captain America's Lois Lane in this arc. Like that's how she's kind of like portrayed, where she's like the, I would say like the Margot Kidder like Lois Lane, where she's like kind of like peppy and
There's
like excited.
an issue a few years before this storyline where Bernie has just kind of started dating Steve Rogers, and he does the Spider-Man thing where he has to rush off and then he comes back as Captain America fight the bad guys. And she immediately, and this is such an iconic, lives in my brain, she's like, wait a minute, that's fucking Steve Rogers. Like, I know that's him. And like then she confronts him the very next issue, and you're like, yay, like a smart woman.
Yes, where she's not like glasses.
There's also some great shit with Arnie Roth here. Arnie Roth is a
Yes.
character that Anthony Oliveira has really brought back in just such a prominent, incredible way. He's kind of just this doughy, older, lonely story. De Matteis created this character. He is very canonically gay, although it never quite says it. It's also very closely portrayed as like he was in love with Steve when they were kids. He was also Steve's hero. He was like the guy that would beat up the bullies who would pick on little skinny Steve Rogers, you know? He's a war hero. And there's a moment in an earlier issue where Steve like realizes he's gay and was like, buddy, I love you. And Arnie's like, oh my God, I love you too. But
Well,
then his
so like,
partner dies. It's really
yeah,
sad.
Nomad has kind of a shitty line where it's like, where Steve is like, oh yeah, Arnie is my friend or whatever, we grew up together, blah, blah, blah. And Nomad's like, well, what else is he? The way he was talking about, and then they get cut off, by
Nomad's
going
also really
to
shitty to
battle.
D-Man later, so
I
he's
mean,
canonically homophobic along
well,
the
I mean, you mean the guy who turns out to be homeless and weird?
But also queer. So
Well,
Mother.
oh no, I was talking about Nomad. I wasn't talking about D-Man.
Oh yeah. Well, D-Man also ends up homeless. So Mother Superior and Baron Zemo, this little team up, they want to hit Cap from the perspective of his allies, who the Red Skull deems as not worthy of Cap, his true enemy, right? Cap's hanging out with Jewish people and black people and pacifists and homosexuals. And they like really quite horridly attack Arnie with these like nightmares. They're really torturing him. And it gets worse for him before it gets better at the end of the storyline.
I love the fact that they're fleshing out these side characters and like making them important because, again, in order for you to care about them being captured by the villain, you need to care about them first. This is my introduction to Dave Cox and him being an amputee. Like, we're introduced to him giving his son a literal bath in the bathtub, which is adorable. And then, like, you meet his wife, and it's like this cute little family. It's very adorable. And, like, and when, because when Cap shows up, Dave's like, oh, so you are fighting a villain down here in these parts, as though, like, again, they're in Virginia, like, they're super that south, but whatever. He was super fun. And also, I think it's weird that they brainwash him and give him, like, the Demon Slayer costume with, like, the teleporting cape, which is super weird because what isn't that guy still existing over in the
Yeah,
Champions?
Devil Slayer. Yeah, Simon Pegg, the Devil Slayer, crazy, crazy Defenders character. Dave Cox has 12 appearances. After this storyline ends in Cap 300, we don't see him again for 25 years, and he's only shown up in one comic book since then. That was like
Wow.
2009. And then Helmut Zemo, of course, as the heir to Baron Zemo. Now, in November, we're going to be doing the trial of Baron Zemo on my show. I have a lot to say about this guy. We have Sin, Mother Superior, and Baron Zemo as the next generation. Their fathers are like Nazi war criminals, and the expectation that they will carry on the legacy is a big piece of these characters.
I mean, it's like the evil incarnate. It's also like it's the team up that like Fenris wishes that they were. Like, you know what
Oh,
I mean?
you know Andrea Strucker's dressed as a nun before.
For Andreas, of course. But also like both of them sort of feeling the pressure of like, oh, like I have to be perfect. And then when he sees Red Skull, he's like, oh, it's Red Skull. Like, oh my gosh, this like puts even more pressure on it. And I think it's kind of interesting. It's kind of like the play on like a legacy hero character where it's like, oh, a legacy villain where it's like, oh, I don't want to fuck up in front of like my greatest hero,
Yeah.
kind of thing. And also like Red Skull in the issues that he's in is portrayed mostly like in the shadows. Like you really don't ever get a really good look at him in most of these issues. And
Yeah.
so like at first I was wondering, I was like, is this really Red Skull? Or is like Sin playing a game? Oh no, this is Sin. And I remember when you first sent me her stuff, like, oh yeah, like no,
Yeah, we'll get
she's
into the origins of sin in an upcoming
Yeah. And then I remembered like sort of like what her whole deal was. I was like, no, this is the Red Skull. But it's interesting that again, they're not like showing him. They're just telling you that it's him. Is it to put a shadow of a doubt that this may not be the Red Skull? I don't know. It's very fun. It's very old school villainy nonsense.
Now, there's a number of reasons I wanted you on for this episode in particular, mostly for the Sisters of Sin, but also Demanda and I, although we are recent friends in the last 3 years, we're close friends. And Demanda and I both grew up Mormon. So this is Nazism in the veil of Catholicism, which is an odd comparison. And you heard me with my opening talk about how fascism will often draw hard lines against certain people, transgender people, Jewish people, you know, whoever that is. immigrants, but then they have to win the loyalty of others by kind of framing it a certain way, even though the agenda ultimately does not match what the values of that religion are. Now, religions already have a lot of hateful messages against people that are different anyway, but when we compare this to 2025 America and this kind of Nazism or fascism veiled as like Christianity and
The
like
white
the
Christian.
entrenched awful Aryanism of it all, there's some really bizarre Nazi parallels to what Hitler was trying to do. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on the story or even just the topic of Christian fascism, because fuck all of this. I hate it so much. This is
Oh,
terrible right now.
it's exhausting, is what it is, because it's so interesting that these white people, and it's also funny talking about this as like white people, but like these white people who will take a religion that has been around for thousands of years, started in the Middle East, and still make it all about white people. And it's like, baby, this had nothing to do with you. This still kind of has nothing to do with you. And so it's so interesting that like they took this and made it to be such a thing, and like what a powerful tool it is, in the sense of if you blanket your bad deeds under this veil of religion and this veil of, but we're doing it for the right reasons and because, you know, because God said so, how many people kind of fall for that?
Right.
It's
Meanwhile, we're shooting nuns out in the woods, right?
right. It's crazy. Or like we're kidnapping people off the street and selling them off to foreign countries. Like
Fucking alligator Alcatraz. No phrase makes me more angry than that one right
right.
now.
And it's so crazy to me that these white Christians will somehow make up excuses that these are somehow good things. And I'm like, so not only did you not pay attention in church in all of the lessons that we all have been taught and learned since children going to church, but you also didn't pay attention in school and in history class. Like you are willfully being ignorant to what is actually happening in the world in order for what? For you to feel better, for you to feel superior, for you to feel like you have that you are the one who's going to be in control, as though if you were as seen as any kind of threat, you wouldn't be next. And like that's like the crazy thing that I think a lot of people don't get, that it's like, yeah, you're in the in crowd until you're not in the in crowd anymore. I
And
mean,
I think it's easy for people to draw this comparison. The hanging of a MAGA flag at this point, with messages like drain the swamp and try that in a small town, that is kind of akin to the hanging of a swastika, which is a rough thing to realize, but it's kind of a bit of a hate crime at this point. But for certain people, the hanging of a cross is the same thing, which is funny for you and I because we grew up in a very entrenched, culty, awful religion, but we didn't use crosses. Mormons don't use crosses, but it becomes very much the sign of I'm allowed to do this to you because I'm morally superior because of my values, which is the antithetical response to any Christian staple ever. But the Nazis were literally rewriting the Bible. Ah!
Yes,
Trump's selling the Bible. Ah!
the winners of history are the ones who get to write it. It's crazy to you know, people are mad about quote unquote rewriting history. And I'm like, no, they're not rewriting history. They're just telling you what actually happened instead of what America wanted us to believe had happened. Because even so, again, also growing up in a Mormon household, and my parents being from Utah, most of my cousins still living in Utah, and us going out there to visit a lot. Westerns are a big part of our culture, obviously, and like watching Western movies and that sort of like, you know, amazing cowboy stories. And like watching them now, there's some that I can still kind of watch and be like, okay, well, this is kind of fun. But there are some that I just can't anymore. And thinking about like how false all of these narratives are, like anything that's like relatively quote unquote historical, I'm like, no, that is obviously like not what happened.
Yeah, I am not Christian in my belief at any point. In fact, I'd consider myself an atheist if I have to use a label, but I am Christian in adjective, right? Like, I'm a very Christian person. I'm kind to people, I make room for people. The story of those nuns staying behind to like help the town and knowing they were going to be executed, I think that would be be me, even though that's heartbreaking to have to make a decision like that, right? I'm a social worker. But when you veil all of this, so for listeners of my show, we keep this fun, but part of the reason we're having these conversations is to keep it real at the same time. And when we're framing it with these stories, it allows me the room to give voice to some of what I think a lot of us are feeling these days, even though I know these conversations are triggering. I hope you're like, fuck yeah, but also you want to punch a wall at the same time.
Right. And also, I think you're very smart in doing like these small little bursts instead of like trying to tackle all of this in like
Let's
a
do it 12
2 hour.
hours on the Red Skull.
Right, exactly. This story in particular, it also like it's a little bit of the idea of like it being a little camp, because obviously like Mother Superior is so campy, like right, like that, the like the villainous camp of it. And so it's almost like, do I wonder whether or not we that has that wasn't helpful. Like
Well, and the
and
two of us grew up queer in this, right? So we
right.
literally have a large portion of an issue where a lady in a nun costume and a man in a Nazi costume are torturing a gay Jewish man with thoughts of his gay lover coming back from the dead to eat him. Like,
Yes.
wow. Jane DeMatteis, my friend, I love you. Wow.
Wow. Again, I know that like memes are a little bit harmful as well, and like in this day and age, but like I saw a meme recently where it was like, what's something that you feel like changed? And it's like, oh, like realizing that Nazis are always the bad guy. So it's like when this story was written, Nazis are of course the bad guy. So there was never any question that these guys were the bad guys. They are villains. They are horrible people. They are gonna have to be defeated by the good guy. But like
So fast
that.
forward to the end, Captain America 300. Captain America is an old man because Red Skull's aged him up, and Red Skull's an even older man, and it's a fist fight to the death. Red Skull wants them to die together. He's poisoned them both. We're gonna have a fist fight so we can battle for eternity. You're my only worthy foe, you beautiful blonde Aryan. This is basically the Red Skull's story. And there's a big fight, and at the end, Cap's like, dude, I'm not gonna kill you. And the Red Skull's like, you must! And then he just has a heart attack and dies. And, like, it's the perfect ending because this pathetic
Right.
man just falls over and you're like, yay.
Yes. It's so but and anyway, so like the camp of it all, because like even that, like what a great ending to like this horrible, terrible like villain. But also he still has like this like cunty daughter who he like aged up.
And he named her Cynthia,
I
Sinthia,
know. And
Cynthia.
it's so And I, again, I'm forgetting how or why or whatever. And again, we don't have to get into it, but like he gave her like these magic powers that she then loses, which makes zero sense.
We'll talk. So in two more Red Skull conversations, we're gonna go into the origins of Sid. So
Yeah.
everybody stay tuned.
Just...
Demanda, I love you. You're one of my favorite people on
Oh,
the whole planet. We just got to hang out on Uncanny Experience as I'm
yes.
recording this, so I'm just riding high, and I can't wait to see you in New York in a couple of
I
weeks.
know. I'm very excited.
Any final thoughts?
I mean, so these stories, also the A stories in these, are super fun.
Yeah, it's a good
It's old school
comic.
comics nonsense, which is again would recommend. If you like slow burn, if you like where you get like sort of that reprieve of kind of nonsense, and also like the whole Tumblr 2 issue is also like really fun, because like Cap does like the Sailor Moon thing where he turns his villain into a friend, which is kind of awesome. But yeah, it was a fun little story to read this afternoon before recording.
There's a lot of banger Captain America comics, but Jam DeMatteis leading into Mark Gruenwald right afterward, you could read a whole like 150 issues in a row, and they stay pretty great. Because this is a reminder of what America's supposed to be according to the value system in the 1980s, and standing up for the underdog and fighting against the oppressive Nazism, right?
And, well, and I was gonna say, like, Cap in this book is like what everyone wants Captain to be. Like when people talk about Captain America, like this is that ideal. He's a nice guy. He wants everyone to be good. He
He's
wants
playing
to help
cards
out.
with a black man, a gay Jew, his Jewish girlfriend, and his pacifist soldier friend are all hanging out around
Yeah,
the city,
just
right? That's
hanging out. Yeah, exactly.
all right, Demand, I love you. Everybody, stay tuned. We'll see you back here next time for our next Red Skull conversation.
Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Finish up projects with GE-branded silicone sealants. Tub and tile silicone is 100% waterproof and offers same-day water readiness, making it perfect to use in kitchens and bathrooms. Shop our selection of GE sealants in-store and on Menards.com and save big. Plus, check out the weekly flyer to view all of our other great deals happening this week.